You're listening to Crossing the Line, a weekly podcast dedicated to giving voice to the voiceless in occupied Palestine. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
This week on Crossing the Line.
We see violence against detainees during arrest. It's beating, it's kicking, it's humiliation. Often it's violence against family members.
A scathing report issued by the Public Committee Against Torture in Israel, or PACATI, quote, reveals the widespread phenomena of violence against bound Palestinian detainees by IDF soldiers and the almost absolute indifference of the IDF, the Ministry of Defense, and the Knesset towards the existence of this phenomenon, and the need to take action in order to eradicate it completely, close quote. We'll speak to Ora Magen, the Information and Communication Coordinator of PACATI, about this troubling document. Also this week,
I must say that the film was accepted quite well in Israel, at least the audience that came to watch it. A lot of people are against the occupation, but they are not doing anything against it.
Independent journalist and political cartoonist Khalil Bindib interviews Israeli filmmaker Shai Carmeli Palak about his new documentary film titled Belayim Habibti. All that and more coming up. But first, the news from Palestine.
This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for August 23rd through 29th, 2008. U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is back visiting the region within the framework of U.S. efforts to resolve the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, while Israeli forces continue to close all the Gaza Strip border crossings, as they have done for more than 2 years. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. We begin our weekly report with the recent nonviolent actions in the West Bank. IMEMC's Rula Shahwan has the details.
The Israeli army dispersed the weekly nonviolent protest in Alim village, located south of the West Bank city of Ramallah today, with tear gas and sound bombs, causing many civilians to suffer from gas inhalation. Salah Khawaja, coordinator of Na'lin's popular committee, told IMEMC that nearly 200 Palestinians, internationals and Israelis took to the streets of the village to violently protest the construction of the wall and settlements on the village lands. The protest started following the Friday noon prayers, when worshippers and international and Israeli solidarity activists walked towards the construction site of the wall. On Thursday, an Israeli military force also attacked the village's nonviolent protest, injuring 9 civilians and causing dozens to suffer from gas inhalation, among them women and children. Moreover, on Sunday, the popular committee in Na'lin organized a nonviolent protest against the annexation wall. Israeli troops fired CS gas canisters, rubber-coated steel bullets, and sprayed foul-smelling liquid at the nonviolent demonstrators, wounding 9 civilians, including 5 children, and an Israeli human rights defender. A civilian was shot and dozens of Palestinian, international, and Israeli civilians were treated for gas inhalation as the Israeli army showered them with CS gas and gunfire during the weekly nonviolent anti-wall protest in the village of Belayim, west of Ramallah. A group of 150 protesters marched after Friday prayers in the village towards the illegal wall built on the villagers' lands. The Israeli army attacked the civilian protesters with concussion grenades and CS gas, causing the injury of a civilian in the head and dozens to suffer from gas inhalation, Iyad Burnat, head of the Popular Committee Against the Wall and Settlements in Belayim, said. Moreover, troops sprayed protesters with colored water. Burnat told IMEMC's he believed that water contained chemical and could cause skin problems. Similarly, 100 internationals, Israeli peace activists, and Palestinian villagers marched after the Friday prayer in Al-Masara village near Bethlehem in a nonviolent protest against the annexation wall being built on the village lands. Mazen Al-Azza, one of the local coordinators, told IMEMC that the protesters were able to reach the wall and remove the wire surrounding the wall's gate and enter the Israeli settlement behind it. Israeli troops dispersed the protest by beating the protesters. Later on, troops invaded the village and seized 8 French members of the international temporary presence in the village and released them after a couple of hours. For IMEMC.org, this is Rula Shahwan.
As the Palestinian ceasefire with Israel enters its 10th week, Israeli forces continue to close all the Gaza border crossings, as they have done for more than 2 years. This and more from IMEMC's Rami Al-Maghari in Gaza.
Israeli troops have continued to isolate the Gaza Strip from the outside world, despite Israel's commitment to open the crossings under agreement, which began in June. Israeli forces have now closed all border crossings to and from the Gaza Strip for more than 2 years. The Israeli siege in Gaza, which has been steadily tightened since June 2007, has had a disastrous impact on the humanitarian and economic situation in the Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, the Free Gaza boats left Gaza on Thursday on way back to Cyprus. 9 international human rights workers are staying behind in Gaza to monitor the humanitarian situation. The group arrived in Gaza on Saturday in 2 boats, having made the 30-hour voyage from Cyprus. The international human rights activists aim to break the siege on the Gaza Strip and to bring much-needed medicine, medical supplies and food to the civilian population of Gaza, which has been suffering under the tightened Israeli siege for over a year. On Thursday, media outlets reported that Egypt said it would reopen the Rafah crossing to the Gaza Strip on Saturday and Sunday to allow 200 Egyptians stranded in the Gaza Strip for the past 7 months to return to Egypt. The continued Israeli siege means that 1.5 million people in the Gaza Strip are being denied their basic rights, including freedom of movement and rights to appropriate living conditions, decent work, health and education. The Egyptian brokered truce between Palestinian resistance groups and Israel began on June 19. On June 19th, however, there have been no major changes regarding the movement of civilians and goods through the 6 Gaza Strip border crossings, which are controlled by Israel. For IMEMC.org, this is Rami Al-Mighari in Gaza.
This week, 9 Palestinian civilians, including 5 children, and an Israeli human rights defender were wounded by Israeli fire in the West Bank. Israeli military forces invaded 53 Palestinian communities in the West Bank. During these invasions, Israeli forces kidnapped 48 Palestinian civilians, including 5 children. IMEMC's E.L. Humble has the details.
This week's attacks focus on the cities of Nablus, Hebron, Jenin, and Ramallah. The number of Palestinian civilians kidnapped by the Israeli army in the West Bank since the beginning of this year now stands at 1,837 following these latest invasions. On Sunday, Israeli soldiers attacked a nonviolent protest against the wall in Nailin village near the West Bank city of Ramallah. Soldiers fired gas bombs, injuring 9 Palestinian civilians, including 5 children and an Israeli human rights defender. On Monday, Israel released 199 Palestinian prisoners ahead of a visit to the region by Condoleezza Rice, the U.S. Secretary of State. The Israeli cabinet had approved the list of 199 detainees for release, describing it as a goodwill gesture to Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. All those freed were from the West Bank. No Gazan prisoners were released. Although Israel occasionally releases a number of Palestinian prisoners in such goodwill gestures, the number of imprisoned Palestinians continue to grow. There are over 11,000 Palestinian prisoners currently being held in Israeli detention centers, according to human rights groups. Also this week on Tuesday, a group of Israeli settlers, some of them armed, harassed Palestinian civilians in the West Bank city of Hebron. The settlers came from Kiryat Arba settlement, next to the city and the occupied Al-Jabari building, a Palestinian house which has been occupied by Israeli settlers for several months. The settlers attacked houses and threw stones and glass bottles at the houses, civilians and school children in the Al-Nazara and Al-Jabari neighborhoods of Hebron. Settlers also assaulted members of the Temporary International Presence in Hebron, an international observer mission, when they were called to document the settlers' assault. On Thursday, a group of Israeli settlers set a construction workshop on fire in Aburin village, south of the West Bank city of Nablus. Eyewitnesses said the settlers from the nearby Braka settlement poured gasoline on the construction equipment and then started the fire, burning most of the tools and equipment in the workshop. No casualties were reported. Moreover, Israeli forces have continued to impose severe restrictions on the movement of Palestinian civilians throughout the West Bank, including occupied East Jerusalem. Millions of Palestinian civilians from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip continue to be denied access to Jerusalem. Israeli forces have established checkpoints in and around Jerusalem, severely restricting Palestinian access to the city. Civilians are frequently prevented from praying at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem, despite the fact that the holy month of Ramadan is approaching. For IMEMC.org, this is E.L. Humble.
This week, U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is back visiting the region within the framework of U.S. efforts to resolve the Palestinian-Israeli conflict before the end of this year. During her visit, Secretary Rice stated that a solution is still possible by the end of 2008, as the current negotiations between Palestinians and Israelis are more serious than they were before. In Ramallah, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas expressed his hope that a Palestinian state with East Jerusalem as its capital will be established soon. Meanwhile, Israeli Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni downplayed Rice's concerns about Israeli settlement activity in the occupied West Bank. Yet, according to the latest report by the Israeli Peace Now movement, 55% of Israeli settlement building units are located inside the Palestinian territories to the east of Israel's separation barrier. Jeff Halper, an Israeli-American campaigner against the Israeli policy of house demolitions, commented on the current peace talks.
It's not a genuine peace process. There's no genuine negotiations. There isn't the idea that we're really going to be together, but that we're trying. Israel is trying through Annapolis with American help to get to an apartheid regime.
Later in the week, President Abbas, speaking from Beirut, reasserted the Palestinian people's right to return to historical Palestine after the Israeli Foreign Minister Livni said that the right of return is incompatible with the creation of a Palestinian state on the 1967 borders. Israel displaced hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from their homeland in 1948. Meanwhile, the conditions for Palestinians in Gaza remain unchanged, with Israel still closing the border crossing and only allowing small shipments of goods and commodities, despite an Egyptian brokered ceasefire between the ruling Hamas party and Israel that began in June 2008. Asked by IMEMC's correspondent whether there have been any pledges by Egypt to solve the problem of crossings, particularly the Rafah crossing terminal which Egypt controls, senior Hamas leader Dr. Mahmoud Zahar said,
"Personally, on the Arab League, I succeeded to squeeze the Arab foreign ministers to decide making an end for the siege, but they failed to implement the practice."
In the meantime, on board the Free Gaza boat, a stranded Palestinian family and a wounded child joined at least 34 international peace activists on their way back to Cyprus after they succeeded in breaking the Israeli blockade on the strip by sailing to Gaza last Saturday. The Free Gaza boat was organized by a group of human rights activists, aid workers, and journalists who spent 2 years planning how to reach Gaza by sea in solidarity with the besieged population. Huwaida Arraf, one of the organizers of the Free Gaza boat, is a Palestinian with Israeli and American citizenship from the historical Palestinian city of Akka.
Israel has grossly violated its obligations as an occupying power and purposely put the entire Palestinian population of Gaza under siege, a form of collective punishment that is prohibited by international humanitarian law. We are going to take this message out with us to the world, let them know what is happening in Gaza, and call on them to act. Then the people of the world must act. We can't stay silent in the face of these crimes.
7 other Palestinian Fulbright scholarship candidates were supposed to be on board the Free Gaza ship. 7 other Palestinian Fulbright scholarship candidates were supposed to be on board the Free Gaza ship, but they were denied visas to Cyprus, the boat's return destination. For IMEMC, this is George Rishmawi. And that's just some of the news this week in Palestine. For constant updates, check out our website, www.imemc.org. Thanks for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. This week's report has been brought to you by Hussam Qassis and George Rishmawi.
In Berkeley, I'm Najee Ali, and you're listening to Crossing the Line. On July 21st, a 27-year-old Palestinian man was shot in the foot at point-blank range by an IOF soldier. The man was blindfolded and handcuffed and in IOF custody at the time. The incident was captured on tape. The footage was broadcast and condemned worldwide, but since the incident, neither the soldier who fired the shot nor the commander of the brigade who held the man's arm at the time of the shooting have faced any serious disciplinary action. 1 month before the shooting, the Public Committee Against Torture in Israel, or PACATI, an independent human rights organization founded in 1990 that continues to struggle against the use of torture and interrogation in Israel and the Palestinian Authority through legal means, released a disturbing report that, quote, reveals the widespread phenomena of violence against bound Palestinian detainees by IDF soldiers and the almost absolute indifference of the IDF, the Ministry of Defense, and the Knesset towards the existence of this phenomena, and the need to take action in order to eradicate it completely, close quote. Joining us to talk more about this disturbing report and its findings is Ora Magen, the Information and Communication Coordinator of Pakati. Ora Magen, welcome to Crossing the Line.
Thank you.
Ora, can you talk a bit about some forms of abuse that are employed by the Army against their Palestinian prisoners after they are in custody in your report?
Okay. First of all, I want to stress that our report covers the period that the detainee is already in custody, which means that he is already bound and does not present a danger to the soldiers, or on some occasions, of course, it might be border police officers who arrest him. We chose this point to begin our report because we didn't want to get involved in issues involving a battle or an armed conflict between a potential detainee or someone who is being arrested and people who are arresting him. What we saw is that violence occurs at several junctures of the time that a detainee is in the hands of usually it's the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, and the time that he reaches his destination in an interrogation facility, usually a GSS, a General Security Service facility. We see violence against detainees during arrest with beating, it's kicking, it's humiliation, often it's violence against family members. This can be just plain kicking or just plain hitting somebody. Sometimes they're hit with the butt of a gun. Soldiers can throw them on the ground, step on them, beat on them, etc. The next point that we see violence, and this is, of course, a very brief summary, is during transportation. In other words, when a detainee is being taken by soldiers usually to a temporary detention facility, very often in a military camp. We have very many reports describe a situation where they're thrown on the floor of a jeep or another military vehicle, face down, soldiers sitting with their legs on them, kicking them, hitting them, or abusing them in other ways. Another very disturbing phenomena that we've seen is the use of dogs. Dogs are often used during arrest operations by the military, and then they are brought on the vehicles with the soldiers because they're accompanying the soldiers. Now, Muslims consider the dogs unclean, and any physical contact with a dog is considered an unclean act. And we've seen cases where soldiers put the dogs on the detainees who are lying down on the floor of a vehicle or tease them with the dogs in other ways, which definitely has a psychological implication. We next see quite a lot of violence in the military camps where detainees are often held for a very brief period of time before being sent on to permanent detention or to interrogation. Again, it's the repeating of it's kicking, it's insulting, you know, verbal abuse, beating, often by more than one soldier, pushing, forceful behavior in any way that you look at it. So that is sort of what our report is about. It's about that period of time between the arrest and the time that the person has been brought to an interrogation facility.
It seems that the only thing that separates the abuse that I just mentioned in the introduction and mm-hmm. the ones that Picotti cites in the report is that the shooting of the unarmed, blindfolded, and handcuffed man was caught on tape, and thus far no serious action has been taken against the soldier or the commander of the unit. Have there been any indictments against soldiers who may have been involved in abuse in your reports at all?
There were indictments against soldiers and against border policemen. I don't think that our report really goes into it that far, but there were cases. But these are a drop in the bucket, as they say. We know from the statistics that we get from the military authorities that only a very, very small percent of soldiers or other security force members who are accused or were charged with violence against Palestinians. Very few of these are brought to justice or brought to trial, and very few of the ones who are brought to justice are punished or punished in a proper way. What I want you to know, that I don't know if you know it, is that we just filed a petition along with other human rights organizations in Israel, with B'Tselem, the Association for Civil Rights, and Yesh Din. We filed a petition to the High Court of Justice against the Judge Advocate General's decision to persecute the battalion commander who allegedly gave the order to shoot the detainee and the soldier who actually did the shooting. We oppose the charge of unbecoming conduct or inappropriate conduct, which is a very light offense and doesn't result in a criminal record. What we've actually asked them to do is, the court to do, is to order the suspension of the proceedings on these particular charges and to charge these two people with charges than they did. Did you see this, by the way?
No, I did not. No. But I wanted to ask.
Okay, so I'm going to tell you a little bit about it. That we condemned the whole way the situation was handled by the Judge Advocate General. We argued that it was a very, very light offense that he chose to use, and it indicates a very weak response to a very serious act by these soldiers, and that it's extremely unreasonable in light of the rank of the officer who allegedly gave the command. And what we're asking for is that there'll be a suspension of the proceedings at this point, and that the charges will be changed to more serious charges.
What's been the reaction of the Israeli public when information such as yours from B'Tselem Yesh Din, from Akri, when you all have issued your reports of these disturbing issues regarding the military, what's been the Israeli response towards all of this?
Well, I think because it was filmed and because the film was shown on television, on all the major television stations and on all the news broadcasts and on all the internet sites that are very popular, I think there was some kind of a reaction by the public. But again, the public sees this as an outstanding case, a case of people who
a few
were
bad apples
doing something sort of the bad apple, or what? It's not something that that is common or something that would happen, that soldiers would behave in this kind of way. I don't think anyone supported or anyone made any verbal support of what happened in this particular case. What our report shows is that this isn't a case of one bad apple or something that's outstanding or exceptional, but rather what we saw, what we showed in our report, is that we're dealing with a phenomenon that happens an awful lot. Our report itself was based in 90 cases, but Picati has hundreds and hundreds of cases that some way or another indicate that there was violence by the armed forces against detainees who no longer presented a danger to the military. I think that many of our cases that are cases of torture or ill treatment also speak about violence during arrest. So that it seems, it appears that violence during arrest is actually a kind of first stage of the arrest and the whole process that a Palestinian has to go through once he's been arrested by the Israeli security forces. It's definitely not the case of a bad apple. Of course, when something like this happens and it's shot on film and everybody sees it, then everybody comes out and speaks about how awful it is and how terrible it is and how these people have to be punished, and this is not the kind of behavior that we expect from our soldiers who are supposedly trained to behave in a moral way, in an ethical way. But we don't see that. We see the opposite. We see that there is a phenomena of abuse of Palestinian detainees.
Have you all confronted the Israeli government and the army about the testimonies and evidence you've gathered? And
yes,
if so, what's been their response?
Okay, we actually spoke, we had a few meetings with army personnel before we issued our report, when we were in the process of writing the report. Because one of our aim in writing a report like this isn't just to expose a phenomena, but also to try to do something with, to try to make some kind of an improvement in the situation, to use a report like this to a positive, constructive end, and not only as a form of criticism of the authorities. So we did meet with military personnel before we issued the report, and we're hoping, and we're still hoping, that we will continue our dialogue with them and in some kind of a way become involved maybe in the education programs that the Army does for soldiers. And they do programs like this. However, unfortunately, we don't see the kind of results that we would like to see. That's one thing. Another thing is that we had our report was raised in the Knesset after it was issued, and the Knesset finally transferred it for deliberation in the Constitution, Law, and Justice Committee, which is a very important committee in the Knesset. But before that, it was discussed in the Knesset plenum, so it was raised, and the Knesset members were able, if they wanted to react to it. Again, we see a blatantly illegal phenomena that's taking place, and it's taking place a lot, and it's taking place all the time, and in all areas of the occupied territories.
Report is based on, as you said, only a few detailed testimonies.
Based on 90 detailed testimonies.
90 detailed
but
testimonies.
It's not the only testimonies that we had. In fact, we see from the large number of testimonies that we have, not all of them went into this report, that we're dealing with a very wide phenomena. And when you take into consideration the large number of Palestinians who were injured during arrest that we know about, we conclude, we think that there many, many more exist, and these people do not complain, or else they complained and we didn't receive their complaints. We don't receive every single complaint that's made by every single Palestinian detainee, of course. So we see that that we're dealing with something that's a totally widespread phenomena.
And do you feel that the reason why these people do not complain is that they don't feel that they'll receive any sort of justice with respect to their complaints?
I don't know. You know, I can speculate about why they don't complain. I don't know how many of them don't complain, but I can speculate that either they're afraid to complain, or else they feel that maybe there's no use in complaining because they're not going to be given any kind of justice, and there's really no point in complaining. And again, they may have complained, and we haven't gotten copies of their complaints. I don't know if they did it to other organizations, whatever. But we know that we're sort of, this is the tip of an iceberg, this report. It's not a report that covers the whole phenomena, but it does cover the basic lines. It covers we covered all aspects of this phenomena.
And finally, Aura, where can people go to read the report and find out more information regarding it?
Okay, of course, it's on our website, which is www.stoptorture.org.il. The report is available there in English and in Hebrew, of course. Anyone that wants a hard copy of the report needs to write to us. Again, our address and our email contacts are on our website, and of course, we'll send them a hard copy of the report.
And we've been speaking with Aura Magen, the Information and Communication Coordinator of the Public Committee Against Torture in Israel, or PCATI, an independent human rights organization founded in 1990 that continues to struggle against the use of torture and interrogation in Israel and the Palestinian Authority through legal means, support of relevant legislation, and through an information campaign aimed at raising public awareness of the subject. And you can check out their website at www.stoptorture.org.il/en, or go to our website and you'll find a link there. Aura Magen, I want to thank you again for joining us today on Crossing the Line.
Well, thank you for having me.
This way is how they always been, and they intend to stay. I can't explain why we live this way. We do it every day. Preachers on the podium speaking of saints, prophets on the sidewalk begging for change, old ladies laughing from the fire escape cursing my name. I got a basket full of lemons and they all taste the same. A window in a pigeon with a broken wing. You can spend your whole life working for something just to have it taken away. People walk around pushing back their debts, wearing paychecks like necklaces and bracelets, talking about nothing, not thinking about death. Every little heartbeat, every little breath. People walk a tightrope on a razor's edge, carrying that hurt and hatred and weapons. It could be a bomb or a bullet or a pen, or a thought or a word or a sentence. There ain't no easy things are this way. It's how they always been and they intend to stay. I don't know why I say the things I say, but I say them anyway. The love will come, set me free. Love will come, set me free. I do believe. Love will come, set me free. I know it will. Love will come, set me free. Yes. Prison walls still standing tall. Some things never change at all. Keep on building prisons, gonna fill them all. Keep on building bombs, gonna drop them all. The wind blows wild and I may move, but politicians lie and I am not fool. You don't need no razor nor a three-piece suit to argue the truth. The air on my skin and the world under my toes, slavery stitched to the fabric of my clothes. Chaos and commotion wherever I go, love I try to follow. Love will come, set me free. Love will come, set me free. I do believe. Love will come, set me free. I know it will. Love will come, set me free. Yes. There ain't no reason things are this way. How they always been and they intend to stay. I can't explain why we live this way. We do it every day.
The year is 2003. The village of Bel Ain is about to lose over a half of its territory to the apartheid wall and to the Jewish settlement of Modi'in Elite. Palestinian residents of the village, along with international and Israeli activists, decide to resist the construction of the wall. The director, Shai Carmeli Polak, joins the villagers in their struggle and follows two residents of Bel Ain, Mohammed, a member of the village's local committee against the wall, and Waji, farmer and father of 10, who is about to lose the majority of his land to the wall and to the settlement. Shai Carmeli Polak grew up in Jaffa and studied film at Tel Aviv University. His movies include Abramov and Zulgar and Pupkin. Khalil spoke with Shai Carmeli Polak about Bel Ain Habibti, his first documentary film, which is featured at this year's Jewish Film Festival.
The movie, the name is Bel Ain Habibti, which means Bel Ain, my love. I didn't come to this village, which is conducting a struggle against the separation wall for more than 3 years now. As a filmmaker, I came as an activist, and I even took part in demonstrations before I came to Bel Ain. I'm a filmmaker, but I didn't do any documentary before this. I started to join the struggle against the wall almost since the first day this started. And
you mean the struggle against the apartheid wall?
Yes. It started in 2002, maybe 6 months after the wall was started to be built in a village called Jayus. And they were the first village that started to conduct this struggle. I wasn't in that village, but I was in other places at that time, doing different kind of activities against the occupation. When Jayus started to struggle, the army really crashed very violently the protest there.
That's one thing that immediately strikes you while watching this film, is the intolerance by the Israeli authorities of any non-violent protest. Why are they so threatened by non-violence?
I think it's obvious. The average person here or in the West generally portray the Israelis as defending themselves against like terror attacks and terrorists and very violent people. It's very one-sided or very superficial way to see the conflict. In order to maintain an occupation, you have to be cruel. You have to kill a lot of people. You have to torture people. You have to do very terrible things. And explaining it only as measures of security is cynical. Propaganda-wise, it's much more easy to deal with violent actions by the Palestinians than with non-violent popular struggle. The Israeli propaganda claims that this struggle is not completely non-violent because sometimes people throw stones at the soldiers. It's organized by popular committees, people from the villages, they organize themselves, and they do declare the struggle as non-violent. They go march towards the bulldozers that are uprooting olive trees and preparing the area for the wall. They declare it as non-violent. In 90% of the cases, the army attacks those marches, usually with tear gas, concussion grenades. Then they go to metal bullets coated with rubber and sometimes also with live ammunition. And then the stones are started to be thrown. And then they say, okay, those people are not non-violent. I must mention that today, a 9-year-old kid was killed by live ammunition in a demonstration in a village called Ne'ilin.
A Palestinian?
Yeah. In the last 3 months, a village called Ne'ilin, which is very close to the village of Bel Ain, where I made the film, is conducting a struggle against the wall that is going to take a lot of their land, like more than half of their land, in order to expand a settlement that was already built on their land, but they want to expand it. This child was killed by live ammunition. And I don't think a 9-year-old child can jeopardize a soldier in any way, even if he's throwing stones.
So this whole allergy to non-violence on the part of the Israeli forces is because violence is their game. I thought this film was very good at showing how sometimes very uncomfortable the Israeli soldiers were with these rather creative and clever tactics of disobedience and nonviolence the Palestinians were using.
Yeah, and their easy way to deal with it was to blame the Israelis that are joining the Palestinians, because there is a deep racism in this society, and it was very hard for them to accept that the Palestinians initiated everything. They came with these wonderful creative ideas, you know. It was art against bullets. So they blame the Israelis that are coming and provocative and encouraging the Palestinians to demonstrate, which was completely wrong. Also, at the end, even the Israeli High Court acknowledged that the root of the wall in Berlin was not built according to security considerations, but rather to real estate considerations. So those soldiers, which claimed that they are only coming to protect Israel, were actually protecting those billionaires that are making money from this land.
Grabbing more land.
Yeah, so I think it did influence some of them, you know, to understand that they are like just tools in a bigger game.
One thing that I liked about your film, in parts was very beautiful, is it gave us a sense of the place. We see the Palestinian landscape, some pockets still unspoiled, the olive trees, the goat herds. Mm. It gives almost a sense of a biblical history, mm. in a sense, except it's the Palestinians who are the embodiment of this biblical idyll. Palestinians with their sheep, you see mm. the Palestinian kids with slingshots, mm. which is very much a David-like, you know, King David-like mm-hmm. image. This irony, is that lost on Israelis? You know, that's the Palestinians who look like the biblical Jews. And if it's not lost on the Israelis, how do they react to such images when they see them?
I must say that the film was accepted quite well in Israel. At least the audience that came to watch it. A lot of people are against the occupation, but they are not doing anything against it.
When you say the occupation, you mean post-67?
The 67 occupation, right. Yes. I must say I'm not a Zionist, and I do think that things started much before this. But I can say about my own experience meeting the people, it was a really strong experience for me to meet a person like Waji, one of the characters in the movie, to go with him in the field and to learn from him about different kind of plants, their medicine qualities, and to see how he loves the land, you know. I didn't think about the Bible when I saw him. I just saw a person that is really attached to his land. And it was really painful to see those ancient olive trees uprooted.
They say they are relocating them. That's a nice euphemism.
Some of them were relocated, but they relocate them. In the beginning, a lot of those trees were stolen. And there was a period you can find ancient olive trees in stores for plants. I don't know how you call it in English.
Nurseries. Yeah.
Yes, in Israel and in Israeli villas. But then journalists wrote about it, so I think they stopped, or they didn't steal as much, and they started to replant them. But they do it in a way that the trees die, because there is a special way to do it, and you have to water them a lot when you do it. And this is a big issue in the occupied territory, the water. There is a very shortage in the water. Israel controls the water. An Israeli settler that lives in the West Bank gets 4 times more water than a Palestinian per person and pays 5 times less. Mm-hmm. If I'm not wrong, but this is like close to it. And the Palestinian society is an agricultural society. They need those water. So most of those trees died. It's really painful to see ancient trees, like some of them are 2,000, 1,500 years old.
And you said the Israeli public received this movie well?
The people that came to watch the movie, I felt that they are like more open to see what's going on. And it was painful for them to see. They did appreciate the fact that I did it, because it showed them things that they knew about, but they didn't actually saw. One of the things that I heard more than once is, are you planning to show it out of Israel? Because, yes, it's important to show it to the people here, because many things that are done are wrong. But remember that there's a lot of anti-Semitism outside of Israel, and you might promote it with this kind of movie. And my answer was, if people are against Jewish people, they don't need the film to be more. And I think it's very important to stop what's going on. No.
Yeah, if they're worried about anti-Semitism, maybe it's the policies that need to be changed rather than exposing the policies. Your film, Bilein, My Love, shows a very interesting aspect of the struggle in Palestine, the dimension of guilt and how it affects the struggle. You show Israeli military authorities punishing the victim out of fear and out of guilt. For example, that man, Waji.
Yeah.
You show how he's not able to work in Israel anymore because his son...
Yeah.
was injured and rendered disabled. The guy is handicapped now.
Yeah.
So they're worried about his father doing something.
Yeah.
So it's a double punishment. Not only did they disable his son, but now he's not able to have a job where he used to work. It's interesting in different places in the movie how you show some of the soldiers. What was the name of that main?
The commander. His name was Tzachi.
How he wasn't feeling too good about his roles in some places, and he was trying to justify himself and saying, well, I have feelings too. Yeah. And also the scene where the handicapped Palestinians go to demonstrate, then made the soldiers even more furious instead of making them maybe a little more empathetic or a little more compassionate. It made them more furious.
Yeah.
Explain that to us. What was going on there?
I think I saw in Tzachi, because there are other commanders there, but I saw in Tzachi a little bit, maybe even a little bit of myself, you know, when I was in the army myself 20 years ago. I didn't serve in the West Bank, and I didn't see what's really going on. But I felt that he feels that some of the stuff there are difficult to be explained. So
that they're doing.
Yeah. Mm. So he held up to be official. Every time he was insisting of reading the closed military zone warrant, he used to put his army hat when he was doing it. He know people are filming him. You know, not only me, there were other cameras there doing these kind of things. And I can tell you especially about this demonstration, he was really furious about this. And he said it's very cynical to bring disabled people to the demonstration. My answer for him was, which is not in the movie because he cut me and he didn't want to talk to, but I did talk to him off camera. I reminded him what Israel did when the International High Court in The Hague was discussing about the wall and at the end ruling against it. What Israel did is, first of all, they didn't go to represent themselves in the court. But what they did is like taking a bus that was damaged by terror attack in Tel Aviv, and they put him in front of the court in the days of the meetings. And I reminded him this fact, and I said, do you remember what Israel did? And it was hard for him to deal with it, like saying, okay, the Palestinians are cynical when they are bringing disabled people to the demonstration, but Israel is right when it brings a bus.
Or the Holocaust.
Or the discourse of the Holocaust, of course, which is very hard for Israelis or Israeli soldiers. There is like a kind of an argument which is repeated. It happened to me more than once. When you ask the soldiers or you meet the soldiers, say, why are you doing this? And he's saying, okay, I'm just following orders. And this is something that is very strong in the Israeli society, this sentence, because this is what the Germans said after the war, after the Holocaust. And when I tell him, okay, does it ring a bell, what you're saying now? Then they become really furious and they say, well, there's no comparison. You cannot compare between the two things, which I believe is right. It's not the same, but it's still, if you are a son of the Israeli nation, you have to be really, really sensitive for human rights now after what happened to your own people.
At some point, I think it was Wedgie who was quite contemptuous. You know, these guys who are nonviolent, this is how they struggle against the occupation, are also quite fearless. Nonviolence, contrary to popular conception, is not for the faint of heart. It's not for people who are not courageous. It takes a lot of incredible persistence and willingness to come into harm's way.
Yeah.
Being
it can be dangerous. Yeah.
It's very courageous people, actually, who can handle this nonviolent approach. And they're often making fun of the soldiers because they know in some ways they're superior to them. They're stronger. They're leading the game in many ways. At some point, he makes fun of the soldiers. He says, if you guys are so tough, why don't you go and fight Hezbollah in Lebanon?
Well, the moment it happened, I wouldn't say it was making fun. It was, he said it out of being angry because it was at the time that the army set a curfew on the village. And there was one reason for the curfew, to stop the non-violent struggle of the village, which is like a collective punishment for the people for demanding their rights. And it was very interesting because those words he said was in 2005, and 2 years later there was a war in Lebanon against the Hezbollah. And I screened the film in Israel during the war, And it was really, really strong for people to see this sentence in those days. You know?
Very prophetic. You see what happens when you find that. Hezbollah. Which was a shock to Israel, that Hezbollah could resist so well.
Yeah, it was a shock for the people. And I think if they want to live in the area more than just one or two generations ahead, they have to understand that you cannot just trust power all the time. Mm-hmm. The people around you can be clever as well and be good soldiers as well. And they are developing also. Okay, there was like a technological advantage for the Jews that came from Europe to this area and everything, but you will not be able to keep this for a long time. If you put the moral questions on the side and just trying to be practical, it is wise to understand that you cannot trust power all the time.
You had a couple of more questions. That one of them is has to do with the democratization of the film, the medium of film. There seem to be more and more young people who are able to get into this field where it used to be big money, it used to be a lot of equipment.
Yeah, because I'm a filmmaker and I was working, especially in the fiction, I know what it is when you need money, you know, for everything, for the crew and for lighting and for a very good camera. And it was like an amazing freedom just to take a very simple camera and to go and to make a film only with yourself and camera. It's like something that really gives you the freedom to do things that you couldn't do before, you know. Especially going to a place that it's not that easy to be. And it would be impossible to work with a crew on this kind of film.
Were you subjected to any hostility at the hands of the soldiers or any of the...
I was arrested as a cameraman, but they treated me in a different way when I was arrested holding the camera than when I was actually demonstrating. You get beaten. They arrested me.
When you don't have a camera, you get beaten.
More, a little bit more. I can say that now it is almost as dangerous to hold a camera. A lot of cameramen were really severely hurt in the last couple of years.
Including Israelis, huh?
Yeah, including Israelis, yes. They understand now that not all the Israelis that are holding the camera on those events are on the Israeli side. So it can be more dangerous than before. They did confiscate my press card, but it was an illegal procedure and they had to give it back to me, which is not that important for me. I don't believe in a press card or things like this. It was technically easier to go with this. You were talking about the courage of the Palestinian to go. It's important to mention about this issue that the army have different open fire orders on a demonstration if there is a presence of internationals or Israelis in the demonstrations. And they admit it. If the demonstration is only with Palestinian, it can be really, really dangerous. Even if you are very quiet, very calm, they can open fire at you in seconds. So this is the main reason me and other friends joined the demonstrations in the beginning. We knew that our presence is very important in order to just make things more calm, you know, just to make it less violent, just to make it less dangerous. During those years, it changed. And there were like some Israelis were severely hit. One of my friends was shot in his head and the bullet penetrated his brain. Other people were shot many times with rubber coated bullet, sometimes with live ammunition also. So I think they still have those orders, but you can trust them less now.
So there seems to be like an escalation, an increased desperation.
For sure, for sure.
For them to keep this sort of thing
from
happening.
For sure, for sure. And also about the media, many times people ask me, how did the soldier let you film them? Well, first, they didn't know exactly what I'm doing, and I'm an Israeli, so it was easier for them to deal with me. A Palestinian filmmaker wouldn't get the same treatment like me, at least in this period. And the second reason is I felt that they feel it's okay, you know, what they do. They just beat people, shoot them, arrest them for nothing, and they feel it's okay. This is the right thing to do, so it's not a problem to be filmed.
There's nothing to hide.
Yeah, and this is something that was really, nothing to hide. They are under the umbrella of the security
law.
Of Israel. No, the security of defending the citizens of Israel.
Why Habibti? Why did you call him your love?
Because at the end, I felt that this story is much more than a political story for me. It is also like I came to Berlin to struggle against the war, but I became friend and I came to love the people I met. But at the end, I think saying I love the people of Belian, I love the Palestinian people, it's still a political statement now in Israel, because in such racist atmosphere, it's really sometimes hard for people to hear such words from an Israeli
person. That's shocking.
Yeah. So it is really my truth, but it also still in its political statement.
You have been listening to Crossing the Line, which is produced by members of the Podcast Collective at the studios of 94.1 KPFA Radio in Berkeley, California. Special thanks to news producer George Rishmawi, segment producer Ali Budner, contributing producers Mumia Abu-Jamal, Rami Almagari, Scott Berguin, Quiva Butterly, and Nora Barrows-Friedman. From all of us here, we thank you so much for your continued support. In Berkeley, this is Nashi Ali for Crossing the Line. Signing off.